As you know, we've been making our way through a little series about priorities in life. And I want to come to this very obvious one this morning. And I've simply entitled this, The Priority of Jesus. Not that it was his priority, but he is our priority, the priority of Jesus Christ. Of having him, not just having him in our lives, but having him as number one, the priority of Jesus. And the message this morning is basically believing that he is above everyone else and everything else. He is over and above Abraham or any other famous person that has ever lived or will live, or any of the prophets that have come and gone. He is above them all. Here are some things that Jesus said of himself. And now something greater than Jonah is here. And then he went on to say, and now something greater than Solomon is here. So one was a prophet, one was a wise man. And in Matthew 17, remember the story where Jesus takes the inner core of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, up on the mount. It's called the Mount of Transfiguration. And there he is transfigured before them, and his clothes become as white as the light. And they've never seen anything like this before. And into that setting, there appears Moses and Elijah having a conversation with Jesus. Now, I don't think they were as white as light, but Jesus was. And this was quite an awesome thing to see and to witness. And then on top of that all, there's this voice that comes from heaven, and they all hear it. And this is what it says, Matthew 17:5. This is my son, whom I love. With him, I am so well pleased. Listen to him. And the implication of that, of course, is that Jesus is greater than all those other people, greater than Moses, greater than Elijah. And do you remember the words of John the Baptist during his ministry when Christ came to be baptized? And he points a finger at Jesus and he says to his disciples, he must become greater and I must decrease. And it's all about him becoming more important and him having priority over these apostles of old. And in verse 53 here, Jesus is asked, are you greater than our father Abraham? He died and so did the prophets. And I'm sure it was with a scorn on their faces they asked him, who do you think you are? And of course, just to consolidate the point I'm really trying to make this morning, Jesus responds, very truly I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. And at this they pick up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. Just simply trying to convey this morning the truth of this wonderful statement that John highlights, namely the priority of Jesus Christ over everyone else and everything else. And I've just mentioned a few things here just to show you just how true this really is. And the response of people to this claim on that occasion was to pick up stones, which suggested, of course, he's telling a lie and we better stone him to death because he made himself out to be God himself. Before Abraham was born, I am. But of course, his time was not yet. And how he did it, we don't know. But it's just encapsulated in that little phrase, how he hid himself. But it wasn't his time to be taken and to be crucified. So he just walks out through them and they can't do a thing. What I want to suggest to you this morning is that the following three things sum up our best response to Christ. He who claims to be the Lord, he who claims to be the Son of God, he who claims to be the Savior of the world, what must our response be? Just these three simple things: honor, declaration, and worship. These three things. To honor him, to declare you are Lord, and simply to worship him. To worship him, to really worship him. Not just in singing, but in life, in everything we do. This was a period of conflict. A lot of conflict going on here. And Jesus is accused of being a Samaritan, which was a first century attempt at a really good insult. Okay? So they insult him here, you're a Samaritan. And then they go on to accuse him of being demon-possessed in verse 48. And can I make the very obvious comment here that if we want to honor Jesus, we don't call him demon-possessed. You know, that's a way to dishonor him, you know. And lots of people say lots of things about him, and they dishonor him. But as far as we're concerned, the most important thing we can do is to honor him as being above everything else and everyone else. So Jesus ignores the insult that he's a Samaritan, but he does reply to the fact that they said he's demon-possessed. And this is his reply: I am not possessed by a demon. Makes it very plain. And then Jesus said, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. And it's as if he was saying, I honor my Father, and you're meant to honor me. Because each time you honor me, you honor God the Father. But if you dishonor me, you're actually dishonoring God. You who claim to have Abraham as your father, he was speaking to the Jews, you understand, these Jewish leaders. You who claim to love God so much, why have you just picked up the stones to stone me? What have I said that's wrong? If we believe that Christ holds first place, we should always seek to honor him. And it's interesting that Jesus says the patriarch Abraham saw Jesus' day and was very glad. In other words, big smile on his face, patriarch David, I have seen the day of Jesus Christ. How did he see his day? In what way did he witness the day of Christ? We would have to say it was by faith. It's the only way we can do it. We have to use our faith. And all those millennia ago, Abraham used faith. That's what Hebrews chapter 11 says, a whole catalogue of people who walk by faith in God. And if you remember last week, we looked at that particular story, didn't we, where God says to Abraham, take your son, your only son, and I want you to go to the Mount Moriah, and I want you to take him and sacrifice him there. In other words, put him to death for me. And we're told that early the next morning, he got up and went. But the writer of Hebrews says a really interesting thing. And he says that he obeyed by faith and was willing to take his son and put him to death, knowing, and this was the son of promise, but he's going to kill him, knowing that God could have raised Isaac from the dead if he had killed him. That is an incredible thing for them to say. So there's Abraham. God has made him a promise. Through his son, he's going to bless the whole world. And so I want you to take your son and kill him. So Abraham goes off. Just imagine he had killed him. Abraham believed in order for God to keep that promise, he would have had to have raised him from the dead. But of course, God stops him through the angel. Now I know that you fear God because you're willing to sacrifice your only son. And so some people might think that was a bit stupid of Abraham to go out and to be willing to do that, or even blind faith, or even senseless. But I have a suspicion that it is a wonderful example of honor. He was willing to honor and obey God no matter what God said. That is what it means to put the Lord first. So when Jesus says, "Before Abraham was, I am," he's claiming to be the one addressed by both Moses and who addressed both Moses and Abraham, who came to Moses and said, "I want you to lead my children out of slavery," and he did. And to Abraham, "I'm going to make you a promise that in your son, I'm going to bless the whole world." And earlier on in this chapter, while Jesus is under fire from his opponents, he makes this comment in verse 28, "When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am the one. I am the one." And throughout John's letters, both in his gospel and in the letter he wrote, it comes out again and again that Jesus is the one. John 3:16, we could all say that together, couldn't we? "For God so loved the world, he gave his only one, his only begotten son, his one and only son, he gave his only one, his only son for us, so that we believe we will not perish, but have everlasting life." And then John's conclusion to his gospel is found in chapter 20. "But these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the one. He is the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you might have life in his name." And then you go to one of John's letters at the end of the New Testament, and he writes this, "My dear children, I write this to you, so that you will not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus, who intercedes on our behalf, Jesus Christ, the righteous one." Over and over again, we find this reference to this one who is to be honored above everyone else. And so our greatest priority in life is to honor the one whom God has sent into this world. And what's interesting here is that following this in the next chapter, which is entitled here, "Jesus Heals a Man Born Blind." Yes, he had never seen anything in his life. He was completely blind, didn't know what it was like to look on anything. He could feel the heat of the sun on his face, but couldn't see it. He had never seen anything in his life. What follows here is, it takes up the whole of the chapter, and it's one of the seven miracles that John records in his gospel. It is the healing of a man born blind. And the story that surrounds the healing of the man born blind takes up the whole of the chapter. After he's been healed, it's as if they want to interrogate him. Just imagine if something really incredible happened at Withenshaw Hospital. Maybe someone couldn't walk, but they walked out the hospital, or someone came in blind, and even before they got to treat him, he says, "I can see everything." Just imagine if the matron or whoever was there pulled him into a room and interrogated him really, really stiffly and sternly. That's what they do to Jesus Christ here. They interrogate him. They give him a really hard time. In verse 28, they hurl insults at him. And why is he treated so harshly? I think it's because there's a double healing going on here. Those who interrogated him twice are spiritually blind to what is becoming so evident to the man who until that moment had never seen anything else in his life. He was able to see. And he was able to see Christ. I was on Facebook once, and someone had put on this little video about this little girl who, her eyes are really bad. She was a very, very small child. And she just got her new glasses, but she hadn't tried them on yet. They were pretty sure she was going to pull them off, because children do. So they'd fixed, before she'd ever tried them on, they'd fixed this elastic thing from one arm to the other. And then they tried to put it on. They were filming at the time. They tried to put it on her, and she was trying to pull it off like this here. And they finally got it on. And just as they got on, they took their hand away. And the baby looked up at Dad, And then looked up at Mum. She'd never seen them before. Her eyes were so bad. And then she smiled. Now, I want you to think for a moment. You've never seen anything else in your life before. And then you can see. You can see people. You can see trees and flowers. You can see everything that's going on. Okay? But the thing that gets to him the most, the thing that impresses him the most, is that he can see who Jesus really is. You've got to see those two side by side. See, the one is fantastic, and the other one is just, I mean, it's way up there somewhere. It's incredible. And notice the care that Jesus shows him in verse 35. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and he went and found him and said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And here was Jesus' most recent disciple, and he looks for him until he finds him, and then he asks him the question, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Which was his favorite phrase for himself, called himself the Son of Man. Do you believe in the Son of Man? And here is the man's declaration of faith. Lord, I believe. Lord, I believe. It's as simple as that. I believe in Christ. I'm going to make him number one in my life. With his mouth, he makes a public confession as to who Jesus was. He says, "I believe in you." And on the day that he was excommunicated from the synagogue, his name was written in the book of life in heaven. And finally, we are told here in verse 38, and he worshipped him. He worshipped him. And I don't know how he did that. He wasn't singing a song, that's for sure. Maybe he got down prostrate on the ground before him. Maybe he fell on his knees. But whatever he did, he worshipped him. And we're meant to worship the Lord our God. And we're told here that he worshipped him. And not long after Jesus declared this incredible revelation to the Jewish leaders before Abraham was born, "I am," the man who was given sight for the very first time in his life worshipped the one who could now see with his eyes and see with his faith. And that's an incredible thing. That's an incredible thing. I want to leave this last verse with you. From a reading this morning, Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Let's just read that again. "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see," that was the man, "and those who see," that was the Jewish leaders who claimed they could see, "will become blind." It's one of those conundrums that we come across occasionally in the New Testament. It's a bit like looking at a tapestry. You know how you only see a tapestry from one side, can't you? And it's a bit like looking at it from the wrong side, and you can't make it out at all, and you just can't see it until you see it the right way around. And I really do believe that if we claim to see in our own strength, we are blind. But it's only when he enables us to see that we really can see at all. And when we really see him, we honor him and we confess him and we worship him as Lord over all.